You've heard our open themes with listeners talking about their vocations.
Missouri dairy farmers, love issues, etc.
And what they're doing while listening to issues, etc.
This is Mark from Michigan, and I am a lawnmower listener. We love issues, etc.
We're looking for more of these elements to include in our open themes. Tell us about your vocation, hobby, or what you do while listening to Issues Etc. Call the Issues Etc. comment line 24/7 at 618-223-8382. If you make a mistake, just start over. 618-223-8382. Thanks for listening, and thanks for contributing to Issues Etc. 618-223-8382.
Do we now have a state-mandated form of liberal religion whose doctrines are now acceptable in the state?
When you have kids, there's a whole lot more to call you out of your self-centeredness.
The reason we stand opposed to sin is not because it hurts me. The reason we stand opposed to sin is because it hurts the sinner.
The Lord's mercy is opened up to us by the death of Jesus on the cross, so that the Christian looks at everything in this life and understands it as a gift from God.
UC Berkeley alumni who still support the freedom of speech love Issues Etc. Fiat Lux and Go Bears.
We often think of these two events in the same thought. We often think of them and speak of them in the same breath. The American Revolution, which we are celebrating at this time here in the United States, and the French Revolution, which in some ways we confuse with the first one. I was in France several years ago, and they were on the 4th of July. They were, I believe, celebrating the storming of the Bastille. There were fireworks. It looked like a 4th of July celebration here in the United States. And you might say, well, one revolution is like another revolution, and France didn't turn out so bad now, did they? But are there real differences between these two revolutions? Differences that not only made a difference then, but even today in America? Greetings and welcome to Issues Etc. on this Independence Day. I'm Todd Wilkin. Thanks for tuning us in. We're going to spend the first hour comparing and contrasting the American Revolution with the French Revolution, and then we'll have Pastor Peter Bender lead us in a teaching on the vocation of citizen and civil authorities. Joining us to talk about the American Revolution and the French Revolution, Dr. Bradley Berzer, Professor of History and Russell Amos Kirk Chair in American Studies at Hillsdale College. He's author of several books, including his latest, Russell Kirk, American Conservative. Dr. Berzer, welcome to Issues Etc.
Todd, thank you so much for having me. It's a great honor.
We have had guests on this program occasionally mention something, and it always kind of sparks my interest, but I've never had an opportunity to go deeper. They've talked about what's happening in American progressivism today as, in effect, a battle between the American Revolution versus the French Revolution. What do you make of this assessment?
I don't think it's wrong. The only difference, or the thing that I would caution about, is, of course, progressivism as we know it today didn't exist during the French Revolution. It's really an outgrowth of the French Revolution. But there's no doubt that when we look at the American and French Revolutions compared, that they were really fundamentally different. The American Revolution would have been a radically pro-Christian, pro-Protestant revolution, whereas the French Revolution was a radically anti-Catholic, anti-Christian revolution. And I think in that sense, the fact that so many of the churches were on the side of the revolution in America, whereas they were opposed to it in France, I think that's a very big indicator. One was trying to embrace the past, the other trying to embrace and imagine the future.
So in that vein, if there were one feature of each of these that, or of the French Revolution, that makes it radically different from the American Revolution, what would that feature of the French Revolution be?
Yeah, it's a great question, Todd. And really, the fundamental aspect of the French Revolution that makes it so different is found in their Declaration of the Rights of Man and Citizen, which is essentially the equivalent of their Declaration of Independence that they passed in 1789. And in Article Number 3 of that document, it says that all sovereignty resides essentially in the nation, and there can be no group, no body, nothing that can exist outside of the will of the nation. And in America, of course, you know, our whole movement was you had this little Presbyterian church seceding, and you had a state seceding, and you had a city seceding. And really, I think the essence of kind of the American character is that we form little communities, and out of those communities comes our national identity. Whereas for the French, it was exactly the opposite. They wanted their national identity to creep down into every single aspect, every church, every business, every school, every marriage. And so it's fundamentally an inversion of what we were trying to do in America.
Was it to attach a perhaps anachronistic term to it, was it a statist revolution?
It was. I don't think the French would have called it that, but Todd, that's the best term that we have, I think. I think maybe probably they would have called it a Republican nationalist revolution, whereas we would have just called ours a Republican revolution. But there's no doubt that statism, whether it's a form of nationalism, it's some form of collectivism, it was very strong in the French mind, really coming out of the works of one of the most important philosophers of the day, Jean-Jacques Rousseau. I think in many ways, probably in the long run, more important than even a Marx a century later. I think in the long run in history, 500 years from now, we'll be looking back more at Rousseau than Marx. Obviously, Marx is important because of the horrors of the last century, but I think Rousseau was there first and really does kind of point the way. And, you know, what a difference between, say, a Rousseau on one hand and a Thomas Jefferson on the other. You know, radically different in terms of personalities as well as in terms of ideas.
Now, just as a matter of kind of history, is there not a causal relationship, but an influence relationship between the American Revolution, which preceded the French? Is there anything there that we can see?
You know, again, a wonderful question, because obviously, you know, when we look at American history textbooks or world history textbooks, it's always the age of revolution. With the American Revolution kind of, you know, and I don't mean to put this too crudely, but the way it's often put is kind of like Martin Luther with John Calvin. It's as though, you know, Martin Luther, for a lot of Protestants, did the right thing, but he didn't do enough of the right thing, whereas they see John Calvin as fulfilling that. A lot of historians see Americans as doing the right thing, but not seeing it do enough of the right thing, and they see the French as the fulfillment there. I don't buy that, actually, in either case. I know we're not here to talk about the Reformation, but I think certainly when we're talking about America and France, they're just so fundamentally different one from another. But it's a common mistake. So even someone as brilliant as Condoleezza Rice, you know, made a speech sometime, I think, around 2006, at which she was at a French university, and she talked about how the two revolutions were identical. It's a common mistake to make, and even really, really smart people make that mistake. But I do think it's a dangerous one, and I think unless we're willing to disentangle those things, we're gonna misunderstand what revolutions are. Part of the problem, Todd, of course, is we don't have a good definition of revolution. A revolution properly understood, if we take the word as is, would mean to start at a point and go all the way around and end up at that exact same point, which is kind of what the American Revolution was. We were trying to rebuild old Christian society in America, whereas for the French Revolution, it was really a movement of 180 degrees. It was a half revolution. And yet, that's when we say revolution in common parlance, we generally mean a kind of overthrow of the past, but a real revolution would be an embracing of the past. But that's just the flaw in our language.
Another kind of mechanism of the revolution that I think is important to at least highlight here, while the American Revolution obviously was not bloodless, there was violence. You have written several places that in a lot of ways the guillotine was the mechanism of the French Revolution and everything that has followed from the guillotine. Talk about that, if you would.
Sure. You know, I take a lot of that, for what it's worth, Todd, I take a lot of that from Solzhenitsyn, from Alexander Solzhenitsyn. He writes in the Gulag, that in his 3-volume history of the Soviet Gulag, he writes that there's never really a moment in Soviet history where there was not a Gulag. The Gulag was founded within a month of the October Revolution under Lenin. And those two things have to go together. There's no possibility of separating. There's no such thing as communism without the gulag. And from my standpoint, looking back at the French Revolution, I see the exact same thing. In the French Revolution, there's no possibility of a revolution without the guillotine. There's always something in that revolutionary mentality, that radical revolutionary mentality, that really demands a kind of Puritanism. And by Puritan, I don't mean in the Calvinist sense. I mean in the sense of honing our morality, or maybe lack thereof, but what was passing as morality, down and down to the narrowest point possible, and then comparing everybody to that comparison, which of course is impossible. Very few people can live up to that. So Russell Kirk, one of my great heroes, of course, passed away in 1994, but he used to always talk about that all revolutions always ended up eating their own children. And I think there's something to that with the French Revolution. We know our best estimate is that the French during the revolutionary period, over from about 1793 to 1794, over about an 18-month period, executed probably 50,000 people with the guillotine. And that's just horrific. I mean, no matter how many problems we had in America, and of course it's a civil war in America, our revolution is, but no matter how many problems we had, we would never under any circumstances associate the American Revolution with that kind of wanton, systematic terroristic violence towards civilians. We did tar and feather people, which is horrible. I mean, you're probably not going to survive a tar and feathering. But, you know, even when we did that, there were always apologies made afterwards. There was always some kind of recompense that was given to widows. Even after the American Revolution, we spent a considerable amount of Congress, spent a considerable amount of time and money repatriating loyalist property back to the loyalists if they wanted it. And that's just not something you see in other revolutions. And I think in large part, our revolution was non-ideological, whereas the French Revolution was ideological. It was based on a very puritanical set of ideals, and those ideals had to be attained no matter the cost.
So how do we reconcile that puritanical bent of the French Revolution with what some would argue as kind of its libertine spirit as well?
Yeah, you know, that is an incredible question, and I wish I could answer that. I don't think I can very well. I do think in some strange way, there is a mix of both libertinism and Puritanism that go together in history. I realize that sounds contradictory, but I think in a lot of libertine societies, you'll have a kind of puritanicalism that will arise. Obviously, it's not the kind of Puritanism that we see in New England, but it has that strain, a kind of Cromwellian strain that says, look, these are our norms. You have to fit them. So there's an irony that in many of the great libertines in society, you also find the idea of a tyranny. And I think Robespierre was one of those guys. I think Jean-Jacques Rousseau, in many ways, even though he didn't have that kind of power, I think it fits with a lot of his ideals. There is a loosening of the marriage bond. There's a loosening of traditional morality in that kind of libertinism, but it also kind of fits with a lot of radical Puritanism. And I realize I'm not explaining this well. It's one of those things that I still have to think out, but I do think there is a connection there between the two.
We're talking about the American Revolution versus the French Revolution on this Tuesday, July the 4th. Dr. Bradley Berzer of Hillsdale College is our guest. He's going to introduce us to this event in some detail, the event that we call the French Revolution, right after the break.
Children are entitled to a relationship with both of their parents, and they're entitled to know who they are.
Dr. Jennifer Roback-Morse of the Ruth Institute talking about her presentation at the 2017 Fall Issues Etc. Making the Case Conference.
And if you take that entitlement as basic and reason backwards from that, what you'll end up with is the whole traditional Christian sexual morality. Get married, stay married, and only have sex with the person you're married to.
You can meet and hear Dr. Jennifer Roback-Morse making the case against the sexual revolution at the Fall Issues Etc. Making the Case Conference, Friday, November 10th and Saturday, November 11th in Houston, Texas. Registration is $120 and includes three meals. Child care is free. For more information, look for the Making the Case logo at issuesetc.org or call 618-223-8385.
the Issues Etc. Making the Case Conference, November 10th and 11th in Houston.
Smartest listeners in radio, you're listening to Issues Etc.
Are you a homeschool parent looking for help teaching certain subjects? Or do you want your student to study the history, languages, and literature of Western civilization? Memoria Press Online Academy has live online classes with master teachers to help you. Their teachers have years of experience teaching, delighting, and moving students literally from all around the world. Your homeschool year doesn't have to be difficult. Visit MemoriaPressAcademy.com or call 877-745-8866.
Are you tired of working nights, weekends, and odd hours trying to cover your bases at home just to make ends meet? At the Cleaning Authority, we call that the multi-job shuffle, and we want to end that for you right now. We'll train you in our proven, efficient cleaning methods, and you'll be partnered to work in pre-qualified homes. Call 314-416-8117 and walk away from the multi-job shuffle with a future in our St. Louis office, 314-416-8117.
Welcome back to Issues Etc. I'm Todd Wilkin. On this Independence Day, we're talking about the American Revolution versus the French Revolution. Dr. Bradley Berzer of Hillsdale College is our guest. Now, we often read about this in the history books, and often they are simply equated with one another, these two revolutions. How would you introduce us to this time and this event that we call the French Revolution?
Well, one of the things I try to do with my own students, and you know, I hope it's effective. I can't guarantee that it is by any means, but I always introduce them to the works of Edmund Burke. And Edmund Burke, of course, was an Anglo-Irish statesman. He was a philosopher. He was one of the great thinkers of his day. I often argue in a kind of mythological sense that he and George Washington were really the kind of twin pillars of Western civilization, really the twin pillars of Atlantis, as I put it with my students. Washington, the man of action and character, Burke, the man of thought, also a man of action and character, but certainly a man of thought. And I try to stress to them that here is this great thinker in British Parliament, the single greatest defender of the American Revolution, a man who time and time again was saying things that were treasonous in Parliament because he believed so strongly in the American Revolution. So here he is, the greatest defender of the American Revolution. He was the single greatest defender of Indian Hindu rights. He was the single greatest defender of Roman Catholic rights, the single greatest defender of Irish rights in British Parliament. And yet, the moment the French Revolution starts, he finds it abhorrent. So I often try to introduce, say, look, here's one of the greatest thinkers of the day. Why is it that he would be the man we would consider the most liberal, the most tolerant, the most rights-oriented of his generation? But he finds the French Revolution so disgusting and so worrisome. And that, I think, is a good way to get into it and to talk about that, because the French, really from the beginning, you know, the Americans, we developed our own culture here. We had a culture that was deeply rooted in the Western Protestant tradition. We are fundamentally a Protestant people. I mean, there's just no way around that. The people who settled in America, the Anglicans, the Quakers, the Scotch-Irish, and the Puritans, they were all just fundamentally Protestant. And they weren't just Protestant. They were Protestant. Yeah, they believed very firmly that they knew how to govern themselves because they had scripture and because they had the English common law. And in France, where you have a corrupt church, the Catholic Church there is deeply corrupt, and you have a government that's also deeply corrupt, and a number of rising businesses that become entrenched in that corruption, there's really not the kind of opposition that can arise there that is fundamentally conservative, that is, that's trying to conserve the best of the past, like you had with a George Washington or a John Dickinson or a Thomas Jefferson. There, you really do have a soil of radicalism, because there aren't a lot of alternatives. You're stuck in this tyrannical situation, and the only way you can really get out of it, at least as the French see it, is to overthrow it. And that's quite a bit different than what we find in America. America, in so many ways, is a reestablishment of proper English law. The French Revolution is an overthrow of. the lingering medievalism that's become corrupt and is just really quite horrific. I'm not sure it warranted the kind of revolution that came after it, but there's no doubt that there were great abuses in the French system, far more so than we had in America.
Is a big difference between the two, and perhaps even the directions that were pursued by these two revolutions, made in the fact that, and you mentioned earlier, that the American Revolution was essentially a civil war, although the other side of the civil war was an entire ocean away in some cases, at least the seat of government was.
That's right, yeah.
Does it make a difference that the American Revolution took place far away from the English government, if not the army, and the French Revolution took place on home soil, so to speak?
Oh, absolutely, Todd. I mean, how you think about just the logistics of it for a moment. Yeah, the English, who are really, you know, we may decry George III. He's obviously no Stalin or Hitler. I mean, if you're going to have an enemy, George III is not a bad enemy to have. He's got his problems and his corruptions, but he's no dictator in the sense that we've seen in the last 100, 200 years of history. He's a pretty tame guy. So one of the things that the English would have had to have done to subdue the Americans, they would have had to have committed genocide on the American shores. And with the rise of militias and so forth here, and that's just not in the English character. They're not going to do that. So it would have been very expensive. The war was already in the British home isles extremely unpopular. And that's one reason the king had to hire the Hessians, had to hire the Germans, because he couldn't get his own citizens to come fight. That's not always, I'm exaggerating a little bit, but that's there. And so there were a lot of things that Britain, because of its own morality, its own stance, and because of the money involved, could not have subdued us very easily. Whereas you're absolutely right. You've got a centralized French bureaucracy, centralized French revolution there. We're talking about next door neighbors as opposed to this kind of abstract 3,500 miles away here in America. And that's really all the way up until the development of ICBMs. I mean, obviously, America was in an incredibly privileged position because we're not worried about a Mexican or Canadian invasion. So we've been very blessed as a people to have those two oceans separating us from the chaos of the world for a long time.
You had mentioned Jacques Rousseau, and I would like you to introduce us to him and his place in, at least philosophically, laying a foundation for the French Revolution.
Yeah, you know, he is a brilliant guy, and I don't want to take that away from him. So I may not agree with him, but he was a really stunning thinker in his day. There was a whole series of thinking going on, series of people in the 18th century that we now refer to as Enlightenment thinkers. And Enlightenment is very different in different parts of the world. So if we look at the French Enlightenment, which is basically Jean-Jacques Rousseau, it's the most radical by far, whereas the most conservative Enlightenment is America, where you have people like Thomas Jefferson, Benjamin Rush, and Ben Franklin, who are far more interested in kind of these neat but small scientific explorations, like what does lightning do and electricity, I think manifesting itself in the Lewis and Clark expedition under Jefferson later on. But in the French Enlightenment, a lot of the ideas that come out there are deeply secular ideas. That is, they're actively hostile to any state of Christianity. Now, granted, in a place like France, the only real Christianity that matters is Catholicism. Obviously, they're the Huguenots, but they don't have a great, powerful position there by any means. They're a very small minority. So if you're taking on Christianity in a place like France, it would have to be the Catholic Church. And Rousseau comes up with this idea, what he calls the social body or the social contract, in which he argues that all of society would best be led if each individual stripped himself of all of his allegiances. So we basically strip ourselves of all of allegiances to spouse, allegiance to children, allegiance to our school, to our communities, even to things as basic as an insurance company. We strip ourselves of all of those things, and then as individuals, we come together as a kind of collective body politic, and we rule as this group of autonomous individuals, but now as one major individual, as a nation, as a collectivist or statist, as you said earlier, Todd. So that's very important for him. Whereas when you're looking at someone like a Jefferson or in the Scottish Enlightenment, an Adam Smith or an Edmund Burke in the Irish Enlightenment, it's much more of a, no, how do we find ourselves? Well, as Smith says, we find ourselves in sympathy. That is, we see our neighbor and we sympathize with them. We see our fellow churchmen and we sympathize with them. We see our spouse and we sympathize with them. So it's always this, for someone like a Burke or a Smith, they're always trying to figure out where our allegiance is. So Todd, just in the half hour you and I have talked, we've automatically formed a little community. You know, whether that community goes anywhere, whether you and I stay friends, whether we talk again, you know, that's all immaterial in many ways. By the very fact we're talking right now and we have a listenership out there, there's a small community. It's not as permanent, obviously, as the community that I made when I married my wife. Those are different kinds of community, and yet they're on the same spectrum. Smith and Burke, as well as Jefferson and Franklin, their argument is that's what defines us. We're defined by our allegiances that we make. Whereas for Rousseau, we get rid of all those allegiances, and then we make one big one. So it's a very top-down view of the world versus the American Anglo view, which is a very bottom-up. So Rousseau is really the first major thinker in modern civilization to say we erase all of the bonds, and then we collectivize as roughly pure, naked individuals in the public square.
How did those ideas lead to the storming of the Bastille?
Well, so a lot of the people, when the French Revolution begins, there are a lot of people who would be middle class and not radical who were involved in it. So people like Lafayette, the great general, who were involved. And they thought they could control the more radical elements. But as soon as you see in Article 3 and Article 6 of the Declaration of the Rights of Man, which is officially passed in November of 1789, and it's what shocks Burke so much. When you see that passed, it already has language that's contradictory in it. So you get a few things that sound very much like the American Libertarian Declaration of Independence. But Article 3 and Article 6 say we need to strip everybody of these rights, and then we only have the nation. So there were a number of thinkers in France who were very dedicated to a kind of revolutionary violent stance, and they had been armed by Rousseau. And that's why Rousseau is often referred to as the insane Socrates of his time, because he is so influential. And he's not around anymore. He leaves his wife and kids. He's departed for Scotland. He lives with David Hume for about a weekend, and he and Hume get in such a fight that he's kicked out of Hume's house. So Rousseau is kind of a non-person at this point, but his ideas take a life of their own.
On the other side of the break, we're going to talk about aftermaths, comparing the aftermath of the American Revolution, which included, well, the Articles of Confederation, the U.S. Constitution, and most importantly, the Bill of Rights, with the aftermath of the French Revolution.
College Preparation Station in Maryville, Illinois offers ACT, SAT, and PSAT test prep, scholarship application classes, college and career counseling, and more. Hi, this is Lori Konski, president of College Preparation Station. We have helped our students obtain more than $7 million in tuition scholarships in 12 years. Find out more at cpsprep.com. Let us help you create a vision and find your future. The College Preparation Station in Maryville, Illinois, cpsprep.com.
Do you have a student finishing up eighth grade at a Lutheran school? Do you wish there were a Lutheran high school close to where you live so your student could continue going to a Lutheran school? What if there was an opportunity for high school students in public or Lutheran school to take classes like Latin, logic, and hard-hitting theology courses? Well, there is. It's called Wittenberg Academy, the first completely online classical Lutheran high school. Visit our website, wittenbergacademy.org, to find out more.
Relevant worship isn't about trying to look and act like the rest of the world to appeal to the culture around us, but relevant worship is about Christ. Hope Lutheran Church of Birmingham brings you truly relevant worship, where sinners gather to hear God's word and receive his gifts of forgiveness and peace. Visit us online at hopebham.org. That's hopebham.org. Or give us a call at 205-956-1930. We'll see you Sunday.
If you've ever wondered why Amazing Grace is the national anthem of funerals, or pondered the state of your eternal soul after you die, the Lutheran Witness has got you covered. Check out the June-July issue of The Lutheran Witness to learn more about death, dying, heaven, and hell. Not a subscriber? Visit cph.org/try-Lutheran-Witness for a special offer, $6.99 for 6 digital or print issues. The Lutheran Witness, interpreting the contemporary world from a Lutheran perspective.
Talk radio for the thinking Christian. You're listening to Issues, Etc.
The church's music from the 2nd century.
Shepherd of tender youth, guiding in love and truth.
The 6th century. The 12th century. The 16th century. The 21st century. The best of the church's music from the past 2,000 years. LutheranPublicRadio.org.
Welcome back to Issues, Etc. I'm Todd Wilkin. We're talking about the French Revolution and the American Revolution, comparing and contrasting the two on this Tuesday, July the 4th. Dr. Bradley Bercer is our guest. He is professor of history and Russell Amos Kirk Chair in American Studies at Hillsdale College, author of several books, including his latest, Russell Kirk, American Conservative. Dr. Bercer, let's talk about aftermaths. The aftermath of the American Revolution was, among many other things, the Articles of the Confederation, the U.S. Constitution, and I would argue, most importantly, the U.S. Bill of Rights. What were the aftermaths of the French Revolution? What did they look like by contrast?
No, absolutely. And again, Todd, what a great question. When we look at the American Revolution, almost all everything in the Bill of Rights is a traditional English common law right. This goes back to King Alfred in the 800s and even before. Everything from the writ of habeas corpus to no excessive punishment to trial by jury, all of those things are English common law rights. So they're ancient and they're rooted in the Anglo-Saxon mind and Anglo-Saxon culture. In the French Revolution, because you have that stripping of all of those traditional medieval rights, and of course a reaction against the corruption of those rights, you find a very different legacy. So one of the things I try and stress with my students is that if you look at the American Revolution, it is a minority revolution. That is, if you look at its influence in history, it has a very profound influence, but not a very widespread one. So the American Revolution clearly is the instigator of the Texas Revolution of 1836, and probably more importantly in world history, it's clearly the impetus behind the 1989 revolutions against all of the Eastern European powers. Yeah, I think about East Germany, of course, where you've got the mass Lutheran protests, all peaceful against the communists. It's so inspired by a kind of idealization of the American Revolution. But the French Revolution has been far more powerful, unfortunately, in terms of its influence. So we see that the 1848 revolutions in Europe are very much patterned after the violent French Revolution. They're suppressed, and you have a reaction. But then we get to Lenin fighting as early as 1898, planning out the Soviet Revolution, which, of course, will take place 19 years later. Yeah, he is so inspired by the French Revolution. Same thing is true in Mexico in 1917, when Lenin, of course, successful in 1917 and 1918 in Russia, the Chinese in the late 1940s, the Vietnamese, the Cambodians, all of these people have been influenced by the French Revolution. So one of the great ironies of history, Todd, is that when we get to 1989, this is the 200th anniversary of the French Revolution, and the Soviets, who are basically bankrupt, are willing to put tons of money into worldwide parades to celebrate the Soviet Union as the perfection of the French Revolution in 1989 to celebrate the 200th anniversary. And of course, with the exception of Romania, all of those Eastern European powers collapse without a shot being fired. 1989 becomes the great American victory and the great, obviously, anti-communist Christian victory, really Judeo-Christian victory, versus that kind of secular French Russovian victory that the Soviets were anticipating.
You had mentioned that the French Revolution is characterized by this radical break from the past, really an attempt to erase the past and blot it out in a lot of ways. Was there a different, and you also mentioned that the American Revolution is constantly returning to the past, attempting to reestablish a right administration of British common law, which wouldn't exist, I don't think, without a robust view of natural law. Is there no view of natural law in the French Revolution, or a perversion of natural law in the French Revolution?
Yes, the French Revolution starts out with a view of natural law that's supportive, but not in the way that you and I would like it. It's much more of an enlightened view of natural law that basically says, well, if nature does this, it must be right. It's not the natural law. It's more the natural law of physics, or at least as they perceive it at the time, than it is the natural law of morality and, say, the Ten Commandments as an expression, God's will, obviously, but an expression, 10 points of the natural law that is rooted in God's creation. So it's a very secularized vision at the beginning of the French Revolution. But by the time you get to Robespierre and the radicals of the French Revolution, basically, nature is what you make it. It's this, you know, C.S. Lewis would project in his own, not only his own writings like The Abolition of Man, but in his fiction, such as That Hideous Strength. This is really nature as we humans manipulate it through our willpower. It's not the grace of God. It's the will of man. So there is a natural law view only because in the 18th century, you couldn't really escape natural law. But it was not the natural law of Luther or Melanchthon. It was the natural law of willpower. That is, it was kind of a barbarian natural law, not by no means a Judeo-Christian natural law.
A predecessor of kind of Darwinian and Darwinian Absolutely. Social systems?
Absolutely. And of course, once you loose yourself from the morality of a natural law, progressivism, and going all the way back to your first question, Todd, I mean, this is absolutely the origins of modern progressivism, the loosing, if I'm saying that properly, of our attachment to the morality that is rooted in nature. It becomes just willpower again. Yeah, we've reversed basically 4,000 years of Judeo-Christian history at that point, which is what the French are really doing. Sometimes consciously, sometimes not, but there's no doubt that that's what the influence. And they've, in so many ways, the French have won. If we look at so many things in modern science and modern philosophy, the French, unfortunately, really have won. Even though we've had great victories, we had a Reagan, we had a Thatcher, but they've, in so many ways, they've won.
So if I take a snapshot of France today, just that country that in which their revolution took place, what do I see in today's France that is a legacy of its revolution?
Yeah, that's a great question. And I wonder, and I'm not a French scholar, Todd, not at least, I mean, I feel like I know the revolutionary period. I'm not so great after that. I know de Tocqueville, but of course, Alexis de Tocqueville was one of the great anti-revolutionary thinkers of his day. He's reacting. His Democracy in America and his other books are so much a very vehement intellectual and spiritual reaction to the horrors of the French Revolution. So he's a French conservative who hates the revolution, along with a number of other great thinkers at the time. There is always that strain in French thought that is anti-revolutionary. So even in the 20th century, you'll see people like Jacques Maritain, who flirts with the French revolutionary ideas, but you know, ultimately he's too Christian to buy into it, even though he will say certain things that sound very pro-French revolution. Etienne Gilson, there's a great person right now, a living French thinker who I think is one of the single finest conservative, and I say that in the least political, best way, thinkers in the world today, a guy named Pierre Manet, M-A-N-E-T, one of the great Christian humanists of our era. Certainly, yeah, I think he's a successor to Melanchthon and to Calvin and others. Just an incredible guy. So the French have always produced these very conservative thinkers, you know, even during, I think, their ability to fight against the Nazis in the 1930s and the 1940s. I think that was significant of that anti-French revolution mentality. But they also have their Jean-Paul Sartres. So France has always, I think since that time, like so many Western powers, it's been mixed. Obviously, the French right now are deeply divided. You know, they're kind of clinging to some weird nationalist roots in many ways, or at least parts of the country are. That nationalism, I think, in many ways, comes from a healthy reaction of worriedness about what's happening to the French culture. But I don't think the reaction itself is healthy, if that makes sense. I think that the nationalism that's coming from the French right is maybe just a slightly different version of the nationalism that came out of the French left. So I don't see either as really good. And I think they both have a kind of dangerous xenophobic kind of anti-Christian element to them. Even if they're anti-Muslim, I think there's an anti-religious streak that goes with that. But Todd, I'm really out of my depth here. So you have to take this as just opinion on my part.
Well, same question with respect to an American snapshot today. People are really worried about whether or not the spirit and the ideas of the revolution still exist today. Are you a pessimist on this?
No, I'm not. Those ideas that we have are so rooted in who we are. And the fact, you know, I think it would have been hell to be a Christian or a conservative in, say, 1950. You know, can you imagine what the world looked like, where the world is basically, you're either an American ally or you're a Soviet puppet. And you know, there's, just imagine, I mean, there's hardly, you know, Protestantism barely has a voice here in America. It won't really kind of roar back until after Billy Graham. And so you've got this quiet Protestantism at home, with a few exceptions, but you don't have you've got a kind of secular media. If you're an American student at a college, what do you believe in? I think that really in 2017, I can walk around and I can pull out my pocket constitution. I can quote scripture in a way that I think would have been very difficult 60, 70 years ago. And so even though it's those of us who proclaim Christianity, conservatism, Judeo-Christianity, we're a minority and we're a weird minority. We're not a minority that's completely beaten down in the way that a Whitaker Chambers would have been, or a Walter Lippmann or a Russell Kirk in the 1950s. I think we've got some good things going on. The fact that, you know, we're at the 500th anniversary of the Protestant Reformation, that's going to be a big deal. That's going to make Catholics think. It's going to make Protestants think. That's going to make non-Christians think. I mean, we've got this element to us. And frankly, we've got George Washington. And no matter how much we beat him around, he's there. And so, you know, if you had asked me yesterday, I might have been a little more pessimistic. Today, I'm feeling pretty optimistic. It's a beautiful day here in Hilldale as we're talking. You know, I think it depends a lot on what day you're asking me this. But yeah, I see a lot of hope. And of course, I'm around 19 to 22 year olds all the time, and they're amazing. So I don't find them to be the slackers that the media sees them as. I find them as very willing, very interested young people who are craving answers. And yeah, they may have some weird views on this or that issue that's politically correct, but they're still, like all of us, searching for answers, and they don't want some mamby-pamby answer. They want something they can get their mind around.
Well, Dr. Berzer mentioned a few minutes ago that in terms of the ideology of today, the French Revolution has won in so many ways. I'm curious, does he see overtones of the French Revolution in America today? We're talking about the American Revolution versus the French Revolution on this Tuesday, July the 4th. I'm Todd Wilkin. This is Issues Etc.
We would like to overlook the difficulty of daily repentance and death to our sins in the interest of progressing to a more advanced spirituality.
Rebecca Curtis from her new audiobook, Ladylike, Living Biblically.
Somehow, spiritual advancement always amounts to our getting to spend more time on the things we like and calling it stewardship or service.
You can purchase and download an audio version of Ladylike, Living Biblically at Amazon, Audible, and iTunes. Ladylike, Living Biblically by Rebecca Curtis and Rose Adel.
Have you been too busy to get your associate's, bachelor's, or master's degree? Concordia University, Wisconsin offers 50 online educational options. Find out more at issuesetc.org. Click the Concordia University online logo and enter the program code ISSUES to waive your application fee. Concordia University, Wisconsin is here to strengthen and support the church. Lifelong Lutheran learning. issuesetc.org and click Concordia University, Wisconsin online.
Listen to what you want, when you want. You're listening to Issues, Etc.
Things when I hear on the radio tonight about Obama being a Christian, but not being good because of his pro-choice and homosexuality stances.
Here's a recent comment from the Issues, Etc. comment line.
Yet I see no evidence of any literature that in the Bible that you stated that says that these things are against biblical teachings.
The Issues, Etc. comment line, available 24/7, 618-223-8382.
Did you know that Luther Academy has been providing continuing education for confessional Lutheran pastors and laypeople worldwide for more than 20 years? Luther Academy publishes Logia, the Confessional Lutheran Dogmatics series, and Luther Digest. Find out more about Luther Academy and sign up to receive their free email newsletter at lutheracademy.com, lutheracademy.com, and like them on Facebook, facebook.com/lutheracademy.
We're talking about the American Revolution versus the French Revolution on this 4th of July here on Issues, Etc. I'm Todd Wilkin. Dr. Bradley Berzer of Hillsdale College is our guest. A major byproduct of the American Revolution was the free exercise of religion articulated in the U.S. Constitution. Now, you can hear Mark and Molly Hemingway making the case for religious liberty at the 2017 Fall Issues, Etc. Making the Case Conference in Houston, Texas. You can find out about the rest of the topics and the speakers at issuesetc.org. The Fall Making the Case Conference, Friday, November 10th and Saturday, November 11th in Houston, Texas. You can also register at our website, issuesetc.org. Dr. Berzer, several times in this conversation, you have mentioned that ideologically, in many ways and in many places, the French Revolution has won. Do you see overtones of the French Revolution in America today?
Absolutely. You know, everywhere. So especially in the academy, there's no doubt about that, whether people recognize it or not. So much of what we've done in the academy, especially, and not as true, again, you were asking about pessimistic or not. Can you imagine just 30 years ago talking about educational reform when you didn't have homeschooling, when you didn't have all of these private charter schools that have sprung up, these classical schools that have sprung up? Even if that only accounts for 5% of the American youth, that's incredible compared to what it was 30 years ago. That is a huge development. And now we're seeing the fruits of it. We're seeing the fact that you can have a Hollywood movie that a mainstream movie makes fun of homeschoolers. That is one of the greatest blessings. I mean, good, make fun of them. That's great because that means they matter. And I think that's really there. But overall, Todd, you look at a place, some state school here or there, or even the Ivy League schools, their whole, by the fact that they have so challenged Western morality, they are down to the point. We saw this at Evergreen a few weeks ago, out in the West Coast. We have come to this point where the mob is right. And that is a very, very scary moment. And I don't think they're going to win. I think we're in a phase in Western history. It's a powerful phase. I think the children of the French Revolution, to put it very broadly, I think they're doing very well. But we're standing on scripture. We're standing on common law. We're standing on great heroes of the past. They're standing on made up momentary power. And in the long run, I just don't see how they can win. Now, it may take a while, but we just keep doing what we need to do. We preserve the great truths of the world. We'll win, but it may be a while. So.
What don't we always
understand sufficiently about the American Revolution?
Well, you know, for me, and yeah, Todd, it's again a great question. I am very taken with the idea that George Washington could have lost, and I think he still would have done the same thing. I think the fact that he was willing to stand and to do what was right, absolutely no matter the cost, and not just him. Yeah, you know, I imagine, I mean, you think of someone like a John Dickinson, someone we barely remember as a culture anymore, unless you've watched 1776, where he's kind of treated as an arrogant buffoon. But you imagine someone like John Dickinson, who had the gumption to vote against the Declaration of Independence. But the moment British troops showed up in Delaware, he was the first guy to get his gun and go fight. And he was a Quaker. So here he is. He may vote against the Declaration because he's not quite sure we're ready, but he turns around and fights, puts his life on the line. He's on the front lines doing that. Washington, of course, throughout his life had to be restrained because he always believed that if he was asking his men to fight, he had to be on the front lines with them, and his men had to convince him to go back. The fact that he literally had clothes ripped off his body by bullets, but he was never once touched or grazed by a bullet. These are stunning guys, and very few countries in the world have heroes like that. We have a whole generation of men and women, people like Mercy Otis Warren, Abigail Adams, who gave every single thing they had for this thing, for this victory. And we see that again and again in American history. American Marines are doing that daily in places like Afghanistan. So you've got this great legacy, and I think that, you know, when we think about the American Revolution, I love the fact that these guys knew they could lose and came very close to losing, but they would have done the same thing because it was right and it didn't matter if they won or lost. That to me, you know, that's incredible. What a glorious statement.
Finally, then, how can we understand the French Revolution? How can understanding it a little better, and all of us have so much to learn about that counterpoint to the American Revolution, but how can understanding the French Revolution help us combat 21st century progressivism?
Yeah, you know, that's going to be very hard, Todd. And I do think it has to come down to that notion of heroism and that kind of mythological understanding of the human person, which I also think is deeply theological and true. But I think we do have to recognize that. And on the left, with progressivism in particular, there are a set of martyrs and there are a set of secular saints. You see that. Communism, of course, was pretty blatant about this, talking about the end of history with the development of perfection. Marx, who was raised an Episcopalian, an Anglican, you know, we often think of him as Jewish, which, of course, racially he was, but he was raised an Episcopalian. You had to think about that and to think about how much he took from Christianity and secularized. A part of progressivism is always a theft of Christianity, because progressivism takes the idea of Christian grace, but it applies it to willpower. It takes the idea of God, but it applies it to history. So we believe that there's an autonomous God who rules over time and space. They believe history is a God that rules over time, at least. So they've taken so much, and the French Revolution did that. You know, we didn't get into this a moment ago, Todd, but to imagine that the French revolutionaries started over with year zero, they started over with day one, they turned the Cathedral of Notre Dame into a secular place of worship for their own French Revolution. They put a prostitute and put her on the altar at Notre Dame and declared her the goddess of reason. All of those things in some way, even though they desecrate Christianity, they're all an homage to the power of Christianity too. They're not starting over really from zero. They're perverting what they've inherited. And you know, I think of no better example than the fact that some of the French monks and priests who lost their own faith and turned to the French Revolution were suggesting that in the guillotine, this was a waste of bodies and they should use the martyrs, they would have considered them just victims, but the people they're executing, that they should divide their body up into a Eucharist to actually have a distribution of those guillotine people to distribute their flesh and their blood to the revolutionaries of the French. You know, what greater sign could that be than the majesty of Jesus Christ, even though it's a complete denigration of that? So when I look to the French Revolution, what I see are a lot of truths that have been utterly corrupted, like all evil, right? Evil is the corruption of good. It's the destruction of good. And I think we have to remember that. So when the French speak in the high-minded ideals of liberation and fighting corruption, okay, that's fine. But Luther did the same thing, but he didn't go out and massacre millions of people to get his point across. Yeah, this is a very different kind of reform. And that's the kind of thing that I think we have to keep in mind. The French Revolution had proper language at times. It had the right impetus, but it went in completely the wrong direction, and it ended up as a diabolical movement rather than a just movement.
Dr. Bradley Bursar is professor of history and Russell Amos Kirk chair in American Studies at Hillsdale College. He's author of several books, including his latest, Russell Kirk, American Conservative. When you purchase this book using the Amazon link at our website, a percentage of your purchase will help support the worldwide outreach of Issues, etc. Just go to issuesetc.org, click Listen on Demand, and look for Russell Kirk, American Conservative by Dr. Bradley Bursar. Dr. Bursar, thank you very much for being our guest.
Oh, I'm so honored, Todd. Thank you very much for your time and for letting me preach a little bit there. I really appreciate it.
Up next on Issues, Etc., we're going to be talking about the vocation of citizens and civil authorities. All these vocations come in pairs, parents and children, husband and wife. And the pair we're going to talk about on this 4th of July with Pastor Peter Bender on the other side of the break is the pair of citizen and civil authority. Those two vocations on Issues, Etc., in Hour 2 in 5 minutes.
Listen weekday afternoons to Pastor Todd Wilkin and guests on Issues, Etc. Issues, Etc. is a listener-supported program. Your financial support is vital for the continuation and expansion of this worldwide outreach. Our mailing address, Issues, Etc., P.O. Box 83, Collinsville, Illinois, 62234. Box 83, Collinsville, Illinois, 62234. You can also donate at our website, issuesetc.org. Issues, Etc. is a production of LPR, Lutheran Public Radio.
If you've ever attended an Issues Etc. conference or any number of events that take place across the Synod and have wondered why more people from my congregation aren't here, check out the special seminar package the CLCC is offering for the 500th anniversary. All you need so the pastors of your circuit can organize, promote, and present a seminar that appeals to the members of your congregation, even the youth, is provided free by the CLCC. Just go to the clcc.org and click on the blue box, or check us out on Facebook.
The third commandment teaches us to remember the Sabbath day by keeping it holy. We do this when we hold God's word sacred and gladly hear and learn it. Jesus invites the weak and heavy laden to rest in him, our true rest, because his yoke is easy and his burden is light. This weekend, rest in Jesus as you hear his word and receive his gifts. If you are in Southern Illinois, you're invited to join Trinity Lutheran Church in Millstadt to rest in the grace of our Savior, Jesus Christ. Learn more at trinitymillstadt.org.